Hello and welcome to the Weekly Defence Podcast, the show about defence procurement and military technology. We are brought to you in partnership with our sponsor, Honeywell. I'm your host, Richard Thomas, Senior Editor, Naval, and on the show this week, we take a look at China's newly released defence budget and explore other military developments from across the Asia-Pacific, and our team of experts discusses current special operations roles and requirements. But first, let's take a look at some of the news from this week. Three UK Royal Fleet auxiliary support ships, Fort Rosalie, Fort Austin and Wave Ruler, could be kept in extended readiness for longer than perhaps originally planned in order to reduce defence expenditure in 2020 as the UK looks to balance its books ahead of the 2021 integrated review. Attention will turn to how the remaining 10 vessels in the RFA fleet will continue to help sustain Royal Navy deployments in home waters and overseas. Spain has released operational, technical and logistics requirements for its light vehicle for special operations to replace variants of the Nissan ML6. The government will spend around €4 million and buying the new 4x4 multipurpose tactical vehicle. Initial deliveries are expected this year and are likely to be concluded by 2024. In Brazil, there are interesting times ahead for Embraer. Despite making progress on key military programs such as the A-29 Super Tucano, the company's defence and security business suffered a 17% year-on-year drop in sales in the first quarter of this year. Senior executives also confirmed that Embraer is taking action against Boeing after the US company decided to cancel a deal to buy Embraer's commercial jets division. Back in the UK, and an American senator weighed into the Huawei 5G debate earlier this week, warning that US personnel could be put at risk on British territory. Senator Tom Cotton told the UK Parliamentary Committee that, I quote, "It would be a mistake for any British lawmaker to misinterpret this potential realignment of US forces as a bluff or messaging effort," adding that inclusion of Huawei in the British 5G network could damage Five Eyes intelligence sharing. So to discuss this and more, I am joined by Air Editor Tim Martin and Land Reporter Flavia Camargo-Spira. Hi, both.
Hi, Rich.
Hello.
So, Tim, you listened in, and I'm keen to get your take on the Huawei 5G controversy. What sort of pressures are being placed on the UK by the US and the rest of the Five Eyes intelligence group? And, crucially, will this pressure work?
Yeah, I think all those questions are very much very pointed ones. And I think what was really interesting that came out of the Defence Committee and what specifically what Tom Cotton was talking about, the senator who was there to give evidence on the behalf of the US, effectively what he was saying was that that if the UK was to proceed with proposals to integrate Huawei into 5G into 5G network, then there would be problems here at an intelligence level, and not least in terms of the Five Eyes community. But I suppose what didn't stand in to his favour, or what he was less assured of, was the fact that, you know, what major difficulties could there be? Because in effect, he said that there would be a workaround if the UK was to decide to side with Huawei. There would be a workaround in terms of the most immediate threats that could be communicated to the Five Eyes community. So, you know, there wouldn't be any, the more fundamental and more pressing threats would still be able to be dealt with, is effectively what he was admitting. But the big debate and the big disagreement between the UK and the US is that the UK intelligence experts are very much firmly on the side that their analysis has suggested that there's absolutely no evidence to suggest that the plans that are under review at the moment by the UK would be in any way compromised cooperation between the UK and the US. There was no resolution between the Senator Tom Cotton and what some of the MPs were saying at the Defence Committee hearing yesterday. But there certainly was a very, let's say, tense back and forth. So, you know, naturally they couldn't go into some of the more technical aspects of this because it is centred on intelligence. But I think probably that the bottom line in terms of, you know, the two perspectives are that the US can leverage the consensus from the Five Eyes community, because, you know, Huawei is banned in Australia, for example. It's blacklisted. And, you know, they can kind of put that to the UK and suggest, you know, that they're out of step here. They're out of step with the rest of Five Eyes. And really that was the argument being put forward. And also we know then that the National Cybersecurity Centre is currently reviewing the policy that was laid out by the UK government in January, because they had initially approved a limited role for Huawei in 5G network. So whether there's a U-turn now remains to be seen. But that, in summary, is pretty much the nuts and bolts of the two main argument and the two positions by the US and the UK on this one.
Well, I'll ask you. I'm going to put you on the spot and ask you to kind of crystal ball it. Which way do you think the UK is going to go?
I think that potentially they will make a U-turn, and you know what gives me any confidence in that. I suppose basically they can say that it's a geopolitical decision, and that perhaps, you know, the aggression that's being shown from China recently against India, for example, and the fact that yes, there's been there's been some debate from Five Eyes and some disagreement that they, you know, they see value in responding to that. But also they could have a one other way out, because the US have said that there is an alternative here, which would be that the UK and the US work on an alternative to Huawei. So now there was no real details given on that, but that's potentially a very easy out to say, you know, to say, okay, we have a viable solution here, and not only would they be saying here's the U-turn, but actually we've got something practical on our hands to be able to deal with this. But in the coming weeks, the review will finish, and we'll see once and for all whether the UK decides to continue or whether it changes tact.
Yeah, I mean, one wonders what impact any removal of Huawei from the UK's 5G efforts will have, particularly if it coincides with the move by the UK to allow Hong Kong citizens holding British national overseas passports greater rights, you know, to work and settle in the UK in the wake of China's threatened security law in that territory. And let's not forget that China is partner to the new UK nuclear power plant program at Hinkley C in Essex. So, yeah, it looks like whatever decision is made will either have a significant geopolitical and economic ramification on the one side versus defence intelligence sharing and status as a trusted US partner on the other. I think it's a case of picking your poison. It's a tough decision.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, I think bottom line, as you mentioned, it's at this point, it's very politically unpalatable to be publicising ties with China at this point, and particularly for something as significant as new intelligence building. And of course, you know, 5G would be the very cornerstone of intelligence in the coming decades.
Yeah, interesting. Thanks, Tim. Moving on to other air warfare news, you've got a story about the first sale of a Bell 505 to Montenegro. The floor is yours.
Yeah, just an interesting one, because this is the first time that Bell have sold the 505, which is a commercial airframe. Light single airframe mainly, but they've sold it to a military operator for the first time, because Montenegro has signed on for two of the aircraft for 3.3 million euro, and these are going to be used to replace legacy Gazelle helicopters, with delivery next month, actually, for the first one, and then the second will due to arrive in Q1 of 2021. A good news day, I guess, for Montenegro on that one. And just on the, maybe a little bit about the aircraft itself, there's no real adaptations necessary as a trainer, and so the has a FADEC engine as well, and which is, you know, useful for training purposes also. A fairly sensible piece of business here for both parties, I would suggest.
Absolutely, thanks, Tim. Flavie, on to yourself. You've got some news from Canada on new deliveries for its ground forces. So, which platforms are we talking about?
Yeah. The Canadian Department of National Defense, Richard, has confirmed the initial delivery of the Armored Combat Supportive Vehicle for late this year. The ACVC is included in the Canadian efforts to enhance the protection and the mobility of its ground troops. This program is currently in the implementation phase. The 360 units procured, it begins this year and will continue until 2025. These platforms will replace the fleet of M113 and LAV Basin. The ACSV will equip the Canadian Army as well as the Canadian Forces Health Service. In September 2019, last year, the Canadian government awarded a $2 billion contract to General Dynamic Land Systems Canada to procure the ACSV. This platform is an extension of the LAV 6.0 family of vehicles that are currently in service with the Canadian Army.
Yeah, GDLS Canada is also the supplier of the Light Armored Vehicle Reconnaissance Surveillance System program. When will this vehicle be delivered?
The Canadian Department of National Defense has confirmed that the first LRSS will be delivered in spring 2021, next year. And that deliveries will continue until spring 2022. General Dynamics Land Systems Canada will hand over 66 surveillance systems. These systems will be fully integrated onto the new LAV 6.0 platform. Currently, the LRSS program is completing the equipment design review process. It will replace the Coyote surveillance vehicles and will provide the Army with its first vehicle based on the Move Long Range reconnaissance capability. This REC version also includes radar, thermal imaging, laser systems, and an operator control station. It's designed to deliver a crew of 5 and can support reconnaissance and surveillance operations either in vehicle or through remote operation.
Well, that certainly sounds like a fairly capable platform. Thanks, Felvia. Coming up next, I catch up with Gordon Arthur for a monthly news roundup across the Asia-Pacific region.
Hey, have you been using the Defense Insight tool that we signed up to the other month?
Have I? It's so useful, being able to call up all those equipment entries and compare specs. I'm not sure how we got by without it.
I know, right? But they've also just launched the Defense Insight Program Index, which is now live on the dashboard.
Oh, I've been looking forward to that. This covers both the current and forecast requirements across all major platforms, right?
It sure does. The dashboard now gives us access to really detailed program information, including requirement data, total spending, contract award years, and first delivery year.
This is great. It links suppliers, bidders, and the system being offered with direct links to the equipment entry pages.
Yeah, and you can export all program and forecasting data. It's going to be so useful for that super urgent project the boss has me working on, looking at wheeled armored vehicle programs over the next 10 years.
For Defense Insight subscribers, the much-anticipated program index is now live on your dashboard. Covering current and forecast requirements across all major systems, the program index accounts for 80% of global defense spending. Access this latest upgrade today through Defense Insight by Shepherd Media.
It's time once again for our monthly dive into the Asia-Pacific region. Joining us is Gordon Arthur, Asia-Pacific editor, who will provide a welcome dose of reason in these uncertain times. Gordon, thanks for coming on.
Thank you, Richard. I'm not sure about the reason part, but we'll do our best.
I imagine it's hard to start any conversation about the Asia-Pacific without talking about China, which in recent days and weeks looks to stamp its authority on Hong Kong, but also has positioned troops on the ground in India-administered Kashmir. What more have you got for us on that?
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned Hong Kong because I spent nearly 20 years there. up until the end of last year. And it is pretty sad to see the way that territory is going as Chinese paranoia takes control. But yeah, we're not here to talk about Hong Kong. We can start off by talking about the Sino-Indian border. And yeah, there's quite a bit going on there at the moment. Now, one difficulty is with that particular area, because it's so isolated, is who you're going to believe, because Indian media tends to get into a right frenzy over it all. And there's all sorts of claims about how many troops are there and what they're all doing and so on. So it is quite difficult to separate fact from fiction. But there is a serious standoff ongoing there, and it's been going on for around about 2 weeks so far. So this is the line of actual control. The sort of much of it is undemarcated or disputed between China and India. So last month, Chinese troops began to move into to several different areas, setting up tents and so on. And it seems they caught the Indians by surprise as well. So apparently this is the time of year, spring. The snow begins to melt and it's easier for troops to move around. So often soldiers along those along that border tend to get quite active and start doing things. And China sees the opportunity. So we're talking about the Ladakh region, which is northwest India up towards the Karakoram Pass. So you've got the Pakistan border there, you've got the Chinese border, and that's where it's all happening.
What's your take on the number of Chinese soldiers that are currently on Indian soil?
If you read Indian media, there's all sorts of claims, 5,000, 10,000 even, but it seems these are quite mixed up. It's impossible to believe that there are 10,000 Chinese troops who have actually crossed over into Indian claimed territory. So I did talk to one academic in the UK on the topic, and he would estimate something like 1,000 to 1,500 personnel maximum, and these would probably be PLA Border Defence Regiment troops who have crossed over into areas that India claims as its own. There's also reports that a mechanized infantry unit of the PLA is in the area sort of backing up, ready to take action as well. And, of course, India has been moving troops into the area. I mentioned earlier on that India was caught napping. So usually at this time of year, India moves reserve units into to various areas or vulnerable places. But because of the COVID-19, India didn't do that this year. And very belatedly, they're just rushing troops in to try and reach parity with this Chinese intrusion.
What can India do about it? And do you think China, it will cede the territory back, will it not?
Well, if you go back to 2017, that was the last major dust-up between India and China, and that occurred in the Doklam region. So that was sort of at a border area where China, India and Bhutan, where the border met. This is sort of happening in reverse. It seems China may be responding to a new road and infrastructure that that India has recently constructed in that area. So the places where they've intruded are incredibly strategically important because they can threaten pretty much the only road in the region that India uses to access areas up in that area. So what can they do? I think in the end it comes down to high-level talks to try and iron out these differences and to try and get back to the status quo. So, I mean, various theories about why China's doing this at this particular time. It's the pattern of behavior. Every year, China sends troops over the line of actual control to sort of test out the mettle of India. I have statistics here. So last year, India reported 663 intrusions over the border. The year before, it was just over 400. So we can see that there's been an increase in this year alone in that particular region. there's already been more intrusions in the Ladakh region than there were in the whole of last year. So China is ramping it up. I guess it can get a tactical advantage, but also perhaps China is sending a higher level warning to the Indian government as well. You know, China's sort of under siege from the US and other countries over COVID-19. It's sort of striking back at anyone who criticizes it. It's been doing this in the South China Sea. It's been doing this in the East China Sea, around of some of the Japanese-controlled islands. So it's a pattern of behavior we've seen from China. The same China continues to threaten Taiwan. So perhaps it sees that the need to keep India in check at the moment as well.
Well, that's all terribly concerning, Gordon. Thanks for that. Away from possible confrontations between regional superpowers, you've got some news on defence budgets, frigates and rotary, correct?
Yeah, so perhaps if we start with the defence budget, and we're going to stay with the nation of China. And we've been waiting for this one for a couple of months. Normally, early March, China releases its defence budget, but that's been delayed by the pandemic. So just recently, China had its National People's Congress, and this is where the budget is announced. So you want the numbers?
Yes, please.
1.268 trillion Chinese yuan. And if you're not up on Chinese currency, that equates to about 179 billion US dollars. So this is the second biggest defense budget in the world, quite a bit behind the US. Now, if you talk to Chinese and read some of the reports from Chinese media, they were talking a lot about how the growth of the budget this year is just 6.6%. And for most countries, that would be quite phenomenal to achieve that level of growth. But for China, this is actually the lowest since the late 1980s for the year-on-year increase. So a sign of financial headwinds for China. It is struggling, so it had to reduce its budget by, or had to increase its budget by only 6.6%. But to put that in perspective, the amount of the increase, 78 billion yuan, is pretty similar to the entire defense budget of Taiwan for 2020. So even though the growth has, or the amount of the growth has reduced, it's still a phenomenal amount of money that China's spending on defence.
What's it going to be spent on? Are we talking more platforms, more aircraft, more tanks, more ships?
Oh, don't we all want to know that, Richard?
Yeah.
That's one of the great mysteries of the Chinese defence budget. So we just don't know where it all goes. China will tell you that it's reasonable and appropriate amount. But for a country that doesn't really have any existential threats, why is it sending such amazing amounts of money? I mean, it's outspending all of its neighbours, any other country in the region. Why does it need to spend so much money? So that's very worrying to many around the world. And yeah, we just don't know where that money goes. Perhaps the greatest indication that we have of how the money is sort of parceled out came in last year's defence white paper from China. And we know that in 2010, about 32% of its budget went on new equipment. By 2017, that number had increased to 41%. So China is directing more and more money towards new equipment to equip the PLA. So in terms of what things it's buying, I mean, it's got two aircraft carriers. We talked last month about two nuclear-powered ballistic submarines. It's got new Type 055 destroyers. It's got helicopter carriers under construction. You've got ballistic missiles, including intercontinental ballistic missiles for the rocket force. You've got J-20 stealth fighters. These pieces of equipment are very expensive. So no doubt it's to keep them operating and to buy more of these goodies for the PLA.
Okay, outside of superpowers, it looks like the Philippines has received one of its new frigates.
Yes, so this is the most sophisticated piece of equipment that the Philippine Navy has ever received or owned. And it's the first of two frigates. The second one will arrive next year. So on 23rd of May, this first frigate, Jose Rizal, it arrived in Subic Bay in the Philippines. It had been built by Hyundai Heavy Industries in South Korea. And just to give you a few details, it's 2,600 tons, and it's going to be commissioned later this month. 19th June is the expected date for the Philippine Navy for this brand new warship. Is it capable? Yes, very capable. It's got lots of things that the Philippine Navy has never had before, but this whole program has actually been mired in some degree of controversy. And a former commander of the Philippine Navy and also the head of the technical committee that was looking after the acquisition, they both ended up being fired as part of this contention. And it all comes down to the combat management system. And as per contract, the contractor was able to install whatever combat management system they wanted. Many in the Philippines Navy was pushing for the Talos Tacticos. That wasn't what was chosen. And instead they've used a Hanwha Systems CMS called Naval Shield. Now, the problem with this is it is not yet linked to the data link, the Link 16. So the ship has been delivered without this capability, which is something that it did require in the contract.
Interesting that you said that it was up to the manufacturer, to the company, to choose which CMS was selected for the platform. I mean, surely every other program says that the customer dictates the requirements, and then the company or the company tasked with carrying out that order follows. I mean, that seems a very odd way of doing business.
Yeah, that's an interesting point that you've picked up on, Richard, because perhaps it comes back to the fact that, yes, this is the most sophisticated program that the Philippines has engaged in. And perhaps, and we're just surmising here, perhaps the all the contractual details and obligations and so on, we're not fully thought through at the time. Hyundai Heavy Industries, they were well within their rights to select whoever they wanted. And it just so, at the time of the contract, they promised that they would have the necessary certification from the US to that their CMS would be compatible with Link 16. In fact, it hasn't turned out that way. So the Philippine Navy is going to have to wait possibly till next year, at least, until that capability is fitted. So Hanwha is working to get certification for that, but the tests in the USA won't happen until next year. The other thing we should point out, it is a capable frigate, but it won't have any armaments or munitions until at least next year either. So at the moment, it looks good and looks impressive, but it has no teeth.
That is extraordinary, Gordon. Okay, what else have we got for us?
Right, so should we look at Japan?
Yeah, please.
So, 8th of May, the very first Bell Boeing MV-22 Ospreys arrived in Japan. Now, this contract goes back a number of years. Japan ordered these back in 2015. So, it's taken 5 years for the first aircraft to actually reach Japanese shores. So they were sent there by ship, and the whole saga comes down to the fact that the Osprey in Japan has a very poor reputation. For some reason, I cannot explain it, but for some reason, the Japanese public think that the Osprey is a very dangerous and very unsafe aircraft, and no one wants to have them flying near where they live. So the location where Japan planned to have its Ospreys operating from, all the locals got all antsy and upset about it. And so the Japanese Ministry of Defense and the government had to find a temporary place to relocate them to. So they're actually going to be initially stationed near Tokyo at a Japanese camp which is already a helicopter base. And they could be there for up to 5 years until facilities are ready further south.
But these are significant aircraft. I mean, what's the envisaged use case for them?
So they're going to be operated by the Japanese Ground Self-Defense Force. So they're not Air Force assets. They'll be used by the JGSDF. And one of their primary missions will be to support the Amphibious Rapid Deployment Brigade, which was established 2 or 3 years ago. Now, I think we've talked on previous occasions about Japanese concern about its southwest archipelago. It feels very vulnerable in that area because China has been encroaching around the Senkaku Islands. It feels the need to be able to defend these islands. So the Osprey fits very well into that capability. It's got the speed, range, payload capacity better than an aircraft or helicopter. So it can get troops and light equipment into some of these islands, which perhaps don't have runways or air bases. And so I think a lot of the time these Ospreys will be used with the Amphibious Rapid Deployment Brigade. And once their final air base is set up, they'll actually be down near the city of Nagasaki, Saga Airport on Kyushu Island, which is reasonably far south. So that'll be the main use for them. In the interim, these aircraft have been flying in the US, so Japanese crews and personnel have been training on them in the US, waiting for the opportunity to get them back home to Japan.
Okay, and last but not least, Gordon, we have a procurement of MH-60 Romeos, I think.
Correct. So the Indian Navy, they've been absolutely desperate to get their hands on new multi-role and anti-submarine warfare helicopters. They've been using geriatric Sea Kings for many years. So finally, a contract has been awarded to Lockheed Martin and Sikorsky. And so they've signed up for 24 Romeos. And it was interesting to look at the announcement by the US DOD. So this announcement came on 14th of May. So it's a $905 million contract. And it's for 24 airframes. But interesting, this contract is 21 aircraft for the Indian Navy and 3 for the US Navy. 21 plus 3 equals 24, correct? So what transpires is the US is actually going to transfer 3 of its own brand spanking new Romeos to India because it wanted to get them as early and as soon as possible so it can begin training. So the first 3 helicopters will be transferred basically to India. And then this contract will give them the 21 extra aircraft and obviously the 3 replacements back to the US Navy. So
sorry, just if I can jump in and ask just for clarity. So India is paying for 3 aircraft for the US Navy, correct?
Yeah, I mean, it's still getting 24, but just because of the urgency, it's getting the first 3 direct from the US Navy rather than new builds coming straight from the production line. So I guess that will just speed up that whole process of getting the first aircraft in the air and getting crews trained.
Was there much of a competition for this?
Yeah, India's been looking at this for a long time. I would have to go back in my files to find out how far back it actually goes. But there was a competition. But in the end, India decided that the Romeo was the best fit for its requirement, and so this is actually going to be a foreign military sale acquisition by India.
I think as well the way that you've explained the order of the structure of the order indicates just how needed that these platforms are, because not only are they buying 21, but they're obviously, as you said, they're getting 3 of the US Navy's new builds. because they need them into service as soon as possible. Because as you said, those seekings are long since past their sell-by date, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, I was in India earlier this year before COVID-19 shut the whole world down. And I shared a taxi with an Indian Navy helicopter pilot. And that was one thing he said. They're just absolutely desperate to get hold of new helicopters. It's been a huge thing. It's been on their wish list for a long time. The MOD and government bureaucracy has been sort of dilly-dallying, and it's just taken them so long to reach this stage. And so I think there'll be many pilots and many commanders in the Indian Navy that will be clapping their hands in joy that they're actually on their way, and they'll be able to get their hands on them quite soon.
Thanks, Gordon, for your time. Let's hope cool heads prevail in Kashmir in the coming days. We'll speak to you soon.
Absolutely hope so. Good to talk to you, Richard. We'll talk to you soon.
While the podcast is a newer venture for Shepherd Media, we've actually been in the defence publishing business for almost 40 years and have built up a strong and loyal audience base. Our content is trusted and consumed by key decision makers through Shepherd Media's multiple channels. One benefit of having such a dedicated audience base is our ability to offer a comprehensive range of message delivery options to our advertisers. From brand awareness campaigns across a combination of print and digital media, through targeted email campaigns or show dailies, to a multitude of online opportunities, or even advertising opportunities within the podcast itself. If you'd like to know more, please visit shepherdmedia.com/advertising.
Hi guys, it's Tony here. Coming up, we have something a little different for you. On the 21st of May, we held a webinar looking at all the news that came out of the recent VSOFIC event. This was a virtual platform for US Special Operations Command to share its emerging requirements, challenges, and capability gaps. I had a really interesting conversation with our panel of experts looking at how Special Operations Forces are evolving, and we wanted to share the audio of that chat with you here. The second part of the webinar will be included in the podcast next week. We hope you enjoy. All right, so thanks everyone for joining us and welcome to this webinar hosted by Shepherd Media. Today we're going to be talking about how the Special Forces community is responding to current and emerging capability gaps and challenges. So first of all, some introductions. I'm Tony Skinner, VP of Content here at Shepherd, and I'm joined today by three subject matter experts to talk about all the news that emerged from the VSOFIC event. First of all is Scott Gooley, who's a freelance defence writer, a long-term collaborator with Shepherd Media, who's really helped to drive our soft coverage over the years. We're also joined by Andrew White, who himself is a former staffer at Shepherd Media and also covers all things soft-related for Shepherd. And finally, Sonny Butterworth, who's a senior land analyst at Shepherd Media's Defence Insight team, who is an expert on all things to do with land vehicles. So first of all, gentlemen, thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure.
So yeah, guys, I mean, there's loads to get through today. There was obviously a ton of news to come out of VSOFIC. I just wanted to set the scene a little bit for the viewer. You know, SOFIC itself is a really important event on the calendar for the SOF community. Everyone gets together, you know, it's a good chance to learn what the challenges, what some of the emerging requirements are for SOCOM. There's obviously a big exhibition that goes along with it. So, you know, industry is able to talk amongst themselves, but also engage with the Special Forces leadership, as well as there being kind of a big international component to it as well. I mean, Scott, maybe we can start off with you. You know, how well did the VSOFIC, the virtual event, replicate all those kind of aspects that we're sort of used to and when we go to Tampa in May?
Even if it didn't replicate all the aspects, it replicated so many of the aspects. I think it was an amazingly successful effort on the part of NDIA and USOCOM. I think those two groups working together came up with really an excellent event that tied it all together. It wasn't just about SOF acquisition. It wasn't just PEO briefings. It was... The component commanders were involved. The science and technology community was involved. Industry was involved. So they really did a remarkable job in a short period of time to pull this thing off.
And Andrew, how did you, you also covered it on behalf of Shepherds. How did you find the events in terms of, you know, that normal news gathering, getting the information that you needed to do your job?
Yeah, Tony, I agree with Scott wholeheartedly. I didn't have a clue what to expect. I've covered Suffolk for many years now, and I really didn't know how it was going to come out. And I was very, very pleasantly surprised. I'd say compared to the previous years in physical shows, I got probably 70 to 80% of what I would do normally. So I think from a journalist's point of view, it was extremely successful. And speaking to industry, who attended it virtually, they had the same feedback. They were pretty happy with the information they got from SOCOM and how that can support their business moving forward. So all in all, hugely successful, I thought.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess a couple of things to raise. I mean, obviously it was open to, in theory, to a wider audience than normal, given that you weren't required to travel to Tampa to attend. I think there was a cameo appearance from King Abdullah of Jordan at one point. And then also the NDIA put a lot of effort into that engagement piece. I know they were doing 15-minute pre-scheduled meetings between companies and PEOs, and, you know, one member of industry that we all know quite well managed to secure one of those slots, presented his tech to the relevant PEO, and then got a call back afterwards saying that, you know, he was keen to sort of set up a time to hear more. As long as, you know, the organiser is able to foster that sort of engagement between industry and leadership, then, you know, I guess these kind of events can work.
I think they can. Just as a sort of a side vignette, one observation I would share would be that as the presentations were going, if you were monitoring the chat rooms, the chat room, as the presentation was winding down, shifted very quickly to virtual happy hours. And people embraced that concept very early in VSOFIC. It didn't work for some time zones, obviously, but that concept emerging so quickly and accepted by so many was a real interesting thing.
I guess that's another key part of SOFIC is going for a drink in Tampa and play Spot the Special Forces Legends as you're sitting there having a cocktail. An important part of the event, obviously. Okay, guys, that's enough sort of setting the scene a little bit. Let's kind of dive into some of the headlines. There was quite a lot of news emerged. There was a lot about, you know, how do the Special Forces community do business in a more contested environment than that maybe they've been used to. Andrew, maybe to start off with you, you covered the SOCOM commander's presentation. You know, what were his concerns? What were sort of his takeaway messages?
So firstly, just to backtrack slightly, Tony, you mentioned we had a cameo appearance by King Abdullah of Jordan, who was like the intro to the commanding general of US SOCOM. And it was very interesting to hear King Abdullah's thoughts on the current current operating environment. His thoughts very much said, you know, look, there's a resurgence in Iraq with ISIS. The counter VEO, counter violent extremist organization campaigns are still very much priority for the international soft community. And he said, you know, we have to be careful moving forward. You know, there's still a lot of activity going on and information sharing and, you know, that so-called international soft partnership that everyone talks about has never been, more important than ever. In terms of General Richard Clark, the SOCOM commanding general, as always, it was his second SOFIC, very to the point. He described three wars on the horizon which SOCOM and the international soft community have to face. The first being the war on the violent extremist organizations, the VEOs. Second was the war on influence. And by that, he meant information warfare, the great power competition, and the importance of partnering with global allies. And finally, this was interesting, the war on talent. sorry, the war for talent, rather, which was his interpretation of how important technology and the people that operate it will be moving forward. So you can take, you know, cyber warfare specialists, EW, artificial intelligence, machine learning, etc. How organizations like SOCOM and their equivalents around the world have to tap into that expertise to maximize technology moving forward. Beyond that, he also made a very interesting observation about the crossover between counter VEO and great power competition operations around the world. Something, you know, which I've always looked at very separately. But he said there's a huge crossover here between the operational requirements. And he highlighted, for example, the importance of partnering. Partnering has been vital in recent years to counter ISIS and other extreme organizations. And he made the observation that in the Indo-Pacific, for example, where US SOCPAC is training with dozens of partner nation forces to bring their skill sets up to speed, he said that's a huge capability in the GPC in order to deter the likes of Russia and China in that particular area of operation. So that was another interesting takeaway I had. Furthermore, again, talking about the duality of CVEO and the GPC, he put it out to industry, like, what can you give us in terms of technology that we can use for both, you know, sets of requirements, operational requirements? We don't want to have a whole inventory of kit that we can use for one or the other. How about something that is applicable to both, which I thought was very interesting. And then he finally addressed recent criticism of former Google CEO Eric Schmidt, who criticized SOCOM for being, quote, appalling at deep learning. And he listed a whole list of efforts that SOCOM is undertaking to overcome this. Probably the most interesting would be the stand-up of a new program executive office for soft digital applications, which we'll come on to later. But that just shows how important the importance that SOCOM is putting on AI and machine learning moving forward. So generally a fascinating discussion from the CG, as you'd expect.
Sure. And yeah, we'll dive into those digital apps sort of later on in the chat. I mean, you mentioned the kit part there, which obviously is, you know, part of, you know, the story that we're always trying to chase is how requirements changing, what kind of tech is being developed. Scott, I think the acquisition executive laid out pretty clearly what his priorities are, and I think he gave six really specific focus areas. You know, what did you take away from his presentation?
Exactly, and it worked so well with what General Clark had said, that his six focus areas as Mr. Jim Smith is the acquisition executive at US SOCOM. His first focus area, next generation ISR. He talked a little bit about some of the things they're looking for. Obviously, that's something that came up throughout the conference, and I know, I believe Andrew's going to be talking about it in a little bit. The second priority area, focus area, is next generation mobility. And that's a range of things. I look forward to hearing what Sonny talks about here on ground mobility in a little bit. And he expanded that next generation mobility beyond ground mobility to include terrain following radars for aircraft mobility, to underseas mobility. And we'll be talking about that again in a little bit. Third area, precision fires and effects. People talk about that a lot. What was interesting was he threw up a photo of an actual piece of hardware that is now out there. And it is a Marine Corps Special Operations Command. It's a MARSOC program where, at least at the prototype stage, they have placed a ground-to-ground missile system on the back of a next generation or a non-standard commercial vehicle, an NSCV. So he said that the current prototype lacked a loitering capability, and that's what they're going to look at next. But the fact is they're actually putting some metal together and working on concepts like that. Fourth area, focus area, is biotechnology. And that makes a lot of sense for US SOCOM, probably with a medical lead, because these tend to be small units, frequently operating outside of the so-called golden hour. SOCOM has developed quite an expertise in medical care and casualty care. And the biotechnology emphasis really is an expansion of that expertise that's already there. The fifth area, focus area, and Andrew's going to be talking about this in a bit, is the hyper-enabled operator. And so I will not go any deeper into that because I know that's coming up. And the last area that we'll be touching on throughout here, data and networks. And as a focus area, how that is changing, the importance, and how it's applied across the spectrum of operations.
I'm dying to know. Let's start on the hyper-enabled operator. It's quite the buzz term. I know it comes from the Talos program, the Tactical Assault Light Operator Suits. Andrew, what is the hyper-enabled operator, and you know, where's that kind of effort going?
Yeah, so like you said, it was a follow-on from Talos, which was a five-year program. Didn't really provide a finalized singular product for SOCOM, but it certainly generated incredible amount of expertise in everything from lethality, survivability, connectivity, and mobility. So I think what SOCOM did last year, they launched the HEO, the hyper-enabled operator concept, to very much look on the connectivity side of requirements. So Colonel Ryan Barnes, he's the director of the Joint Acquisition Task Force at SOCOM, running the HEO effort. He basically coined how the concept aims to provide the Internet of Things and data analytics to the operator at the edge. So working at the tactical edge, the tip of the spear. What was interesting was that SOCOM announced a new direction for the program. Last year we were briefed and it was very much, you know, how they can better enable the operator across, you know, wide spectrum of missions. This year, Lisa Sun is the Science and Technology Executive, and Colonel Barnes revealed that they were going to focus on partnering operations. So as I previously mentioned, partnering with, soft forces around the world, which is, you know, one of SOCOM's strong points, and a particular skill set of the U.S. Army Special Operations Command and the ODAs. And what they want to do is facilitate two-way information sharing with their partners. And bearing in mind that their partners, in most cases, are not as technologically advanced as SOCOM. So, you know, they need to lower the security levels, ease of access into these networks to share intel. What they're looking at specifically in the JATF is an operator-worn computer kit. So edge computing, applications, software-defined equipment, especially radios, open architectures, human-machine interfaces, and beyond line-of-sight communications. They also disclosed that they'd literally the week before SOFIC this year, they just conducted a beyond line-of-sight demonstration in the Tampa Bay area. They couldn't go into more details, but that was interesting. And then they also disclosed that, you know, as the program progresses year on year, it's very much a rolling program. They'll be looking potentially at tasking one of the special forces groups to conduct an operational demo in a theater yet to be specified. Mm-hmm. Finally, you know, they also touched on moving beyond the partnering focus of the HEO. What can it do to support airborne operations? What can it do to support maritime operations? So very interesting what Colonel Barnes had to say, and something to look forward to, definitely.
Mm-hmm. So seeing quite a bit of maturity in that program kind of coming through. I want to turn to small arms, Scott. You know, I know you're the small arms guy in the group. Any updates on that front? Anything you wanted to sort of chew our ear off about the guns developments?
I'm not going to chew your ear off. There were some interesting activities underway, obviously. Some of them surround the soft embrace of the 6.5 Creedmoor round. And it was characterized, the capabilities are not minor. The capabilities that it would provide a soft operator in terms of range, in terms of lethality at range, are dramatic. And we won't get into the little numbers here, but that was one area. Actually, it's being looked at for a new weapons program as well. Initially, it was looked at for the sniper support rifle. Now it's being looked at. There's a mid-range gas gun assault, which is a naval special warfare specific requirement. And so 6.5 could go there. Another thing that was interesting was the discussion on how they're working with Big Army on their 6.8 next generation squad weapon. Their 6.8 millimeter that Big Army is looking at, and they've got three candidates in test right now. So SOF acknowledged they're monitoring that closely because depending on how those programs work out, that could meet some SOF requirements. At the high end, the 338 Norma Magnum, SOF has embraced that over the last several years. The big issue now, there are some combat evaluations underway, their terminology, on a small number of 338 Norma Magnum machine guns that have been delivered. The big push right now is to get the cost of the ammo down, according to the briefers there. They said they were working with the larger services to do that. We know that the Marine Corps initially had shared the RFI for the 338 Norma Magnum machine gun. Whether they're working with additional services to try to get them to embrace that cartridge as well remains to be seen. A lot of activity underway, combat evaluations, watching the Army's evaluations. It's a very dynamic setting right now.
Sure. And I guess there's a couple of other, I can see Sonny sitting there waiting patiently to chat land vehicles. Just a couple of other tech areas I wanted to touch on before we moved on to the vehicle side. Andrew, anything on the counter UAS front? Any developments out of the show on that field?
Yeah, so a huge area for SOCOM and obviously the wider international community. So Colonel Joel Babbitt, PEO Soft Warrior, he briefed on counter-UAS and really highlighted, what is an urgent operational requirement for the teams on the ground. These commercial drones being flown against friendly forces for intelligence reasons, airborne IEDs, and it's a real menace. So Colonel Babbitt, he said, it's huge to get the right kit to the operators at the right time. He said that the guys need this to support small unit maneuver on the battlefield. So a particular focus on mobility. He highlighted, reductions in size, weight, and power. To obviously fit them on vehicles and man pack systems. And also low signature. In the GPC, armed forces are going to be up against high-capability adversaries who might be able to intercept and disrupt these solutions. So low signature to keep below the line of visibility. He also called for, rapid prototyping. This technology is evolving very, very quickly. And, once it's developed, how can SOCOM take hold of it, rapidly prototype, adjust accordingly, and get into the field where it's needed the most. And then finally, interesting, he said an RFP is due in the next 3 months for a systems integrator partner to support SOCOM's counter-UAS programs. So they're obviously looking to bring in a heavy hitter to help them integrate onto ground vehicles and surface vessels for sure.
Sure. Sonny, you've been waiting there patiently, ready to chat about the land vehicles. I mean, we heard that next generation mobility is you know, one of the kind of key focus areas. You know, your job obviously is to sort of crunch some of that data at an international level for the entire land market. But when you look at soft vehicle trends in particular, what are you seeing and which ways, you know, the market's sort of developing?
Well, as Scott said, yeah, mobility is a very big focus at the moment. And I think we can see that reflected in the market. So looking at many of the programs that are currently ongoing or are projected to happen in the future, I think there's a big emphasis on getting the vehicles so that they can be easily internally transportable in the various aircraft that Special Operations Forces use. And then once they've been deployed, also having sufficient tactical mobility to really get to the fight or get to the area where they need to be to make the difference. It's certainly on an international front, and in the US as well in particular, looks like the next 10 years are going to be a busy time as well for this market. Just looking at the programs that we know of, because of course getting data on some of these programs can be quite difficult through the open source methods that we have to use in Europe. Lots of programs. So looking at France, they have a big program to procure the VLFS and PLFS. And there have been some delays on this program. I think the PLFS, there was a first batch of 25 that was delivered, and it had to be returned to Arcus for some modifications. But that will be one program that we'll be looking to see how that develops in the future. There's also quite a lot of, smaller programs where they are procuring quite more bespoke platforms. So Belgium has got the Fox RRV and the LTTV from Jankel. Deliveries of those, I think, are ongoing at the moment and soon to wrap up. Netherlands has procured some vector vehicles from Defensure. But also, when you look at the market, there are some platforms that are recognizable and pop up all over the place. So if we think of soft vehicles, we think sometimes of the small kind of two-man ultralight vehicles that are very easy to transport, something like the Polaris MR ZR series. Again, we're seeing quite a lot of activity in that area. So on the US side, the light tactical all-terrain vehicle, that's a big program that's coming up. The future light tactical all-terrain vehicle. France has also experimented, I think, with a similar vehicle. And I think there are plans to procure 300 Fardier vehicles. And then if we sort of go to the heavier end of the spectrum, in one big program is Canada with the next generation fighting vehicles. So it's been in the news recently that Supercat is teaming up with Canadian firm DEW Engineering to offer that platform. And again, the Supercat is, or the HNT series is something that many special operations forces use. So I think it will be interesting to see how it does in that tender and whether the sort of HNT platform remains quite a ubiquitous platform across the market. Another one that's been in the news a lot is the General Dynamics Flyer, the 72 and the 60. So US SOCOM, of course, is procuring that as the ground mobility vehicle. And I think this is the last fiscal year, by the looks of things, that this is our platform is going to be procured by US SOCOM. But I know, or I've seen reports that Britain has also taken delivery of one or two in the past to perhaps experiment for Project Westerly, which seems to be a program to procure perhaps a replacement for the HMT 400. And then, of course, Polaris also make the Daegor, which has been procured by CAN SOFCOM as well. There's a lot going on to look forward to.
Yeah, so I mean, a lot of activity there. This can be a question for the group, but in terms of the ground vehicle side, is there any kind of game changing technology that's kind of coming through? I mean, are they looking at hybrid electric propulsion, for example? Or is that impractical in a special forces context?
It seems to be certainly an area of focus for the future, yeah, because Scott, you've written about this in a recent piece for Land Warfare. The US seems to be investigating with that for many of its platforms that are already in service. I talked as well about the light tactical all-terrain vehicle. Those were repowered to a diesel engine. And of course, the next step would be a hybrid electric type power plant. Also, I know France is, or Arcus is developing the Scarabée for the French army. But again, that's a platform that could be adopted for special operations use, and that uses a hybrid electric power plant. And I think there are several advantages. I mean, you know, you have perhaps the capacity for silent watch or silent movement, so sort of greater stealth and also range benefits. And I think as well, in terms of design, I mean, these power plants allow more of the components to be distributed across the vehicle, so that could provide some advantages in terms of really maximizing the payload and the mobility of these vehicles, which I think are crucial characteristics of them.
So there we have it, some really interesting comments there from the guys. Tune in next week when we look at aircraft, maritime platforms, and how US SOCOM is looking at the role that digital apps can play in providing next-generation communications to its forces.
This episode of the Weekly Defence Podcast was brought to you in partnership with our sponsor, Nemo. As always, a big thanks to everyone that took the time in being a part of the episode. And for our listeners, make sure you like and subscribe, leave a review on iTunes, and tell a friend or a colleague about the podcast. Until next week, thanks for listening.